Welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show's Tech Tuesday, keeping you on the cutting edge of the tech revolution from WAMU 88.5 FM in Washington.
From WAMU at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show. It's Tech Tuesday. Imagine back to a time when you didn't have email and BlackBerries were just something you put in a pie. Imagine an era when cell phones were relatively rare and served a single purpose, to make telephone calls. It wasn't that long ago. In the mid-1990s, email, websites, and the other technologies that have become so critical to our lives weren't, well, so critical. Back then, experts were just starting to predict how e-commerce would change our economy. And few imagined that things like blogs and podcasts would be as hot as they are today. So, with a decade under our belts, has it gotten any easier to predict what the internet will look like 10 years from now? Will it continue to change the way we do business and communicate with each other? Joining us to share some predictions on the future of the internet is Lee Rainey, director of the Pew Internet and American Life Project. Lee Rainey, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And let me invite our listeners to join this Tech Tuesday conversation. Where do you see the internet going in a decade? You can call us 800-433-8850. Do you remember your first experience using the internet? I sure do. How has your usage of the net changed over the years? The number again, 800-433-8850, or you can send email to kojo at wamu.org. Lee, let's start with the big picture. By the year 2016, some people are predicting that computers will be writing most of their own software and that human knowledge will be outpaced by machine knowledge. How fast do you think technology will progress over the next decade or so?
Dramatically. We're in the grip of three major technology changes that have been going on for a while and will continue on for a while longer. The first is computing power itself is getting ever faster. You've heard about Moore's Law. The founder of Intel said our capacity to create microchips and the power on them will double every 18 months. That's still happening after 20 years of doublings. The second thing is we're able to push more material through the pipes that we use and through the airwaves. The third thing is we're able to store much more material on the devices that we get. The little thing that I'm carrying in my pocket, my BlackBerry, has the same computing power as my first desktop computer in the early 1980s. Those trends will continue, and among other things that we'll see, of course, are that more things and more people will be online in the next 10 years. The internet will become more mobile. It will be in more devices in more ways. It'll be in our cars. It'll be in our jewelry. There was talk at the World Information Society conference in Tunis in November about smart doorknobs, doorknobs that will have chips in them and will be able to recognize you as you walk to the door, or the FedEx delivery man, or the pizza guy, or strangers.
Stop.
There you go.
Well, will it become more user-friendly? It sounds as if, on the one hand, it might become more user-friendly. On the other hand, it might become more chaotic.
It will have to become more user-friendly. The demands for convenience and efficiency are so great. The way that we can manipulate these new tools in our lives, there will be a lot of change that will make things easier to use. As a matter of fact, it's probably safe to predict that 10 years from now, we won't have a conversation quite like this, because we won't think of ourselves as being on the internet. In the same way we're sitting in a room full of electricity, we don't think of ourselves as being on electricity now. The same way the bit stream will become like electricity. The only time we'll know about it is when it's absent from us, when we lose it in a big storm.
Okay, let's look back for a second at the progress of the previous decade. Email and the World Wide Web have come into their element. When it comes to the internet, did things evolve in the way you expected them to? And on the flip side of that, what's surprising about the current online environment?
We actually asked internet experts that question last year in a survey that we got. A lot of people expected email would become the killer application of communication, and it has become. It is woven into people's lives in a way that they couldn't have imagined 10 years ago. But at the same time, if you remember back to the early stages of e-commerce, there was a tremendous amount of over-prediction. People were thinking all elements of commerce would take place online. Every kind of company would have to transfer its operations to the online environment. And, of course, we got the dot-com bubble bursting in the early part of this century. So there were many things that were thought would happen that didn't happen. And the new stuff that couldn't have been predicted is probably the most exciting. When we asked experts what was the most exciting or different thing that they hadn't anticipated 10 years ago, people said that the takeoff of the World Wide Web, all that information on all those web pages in the world, startled them in the way that it grew and the way that it changed the way they gathered information. Other people referred to Napster. You know, it couldn't have been predicted that we would share music and make ourselves available in the way that these peer-to-peer networks have allowed it. But at the same time, there are a lot of people thinking that education would be completely overhauled, that we would no longer teach kids of the same age in classrooms with teachers standing in front of the room lecturing at them. We're still pretty much teaching our kids that way, too. So there's a lot of change, but there's a lot of stuff that is resistant to change.
Lee Rainey is director of the Pew Internet and American Life Project. He joins us on this Tech Tuesday conversation on the future of the Internet. The creation of the World Wide Web in 1989 was a major breakthrough. You say now every 18 months or so we'll be seeing, what will we be seeing? Will those be considered major breakthroughs every 18 months or so?
Computing power will double every 18 months, and that means that more devices, more things will become smarter. But we are seeing Internet applications that couldn't have been predicted before the advent of the World Wide Web and browsers that allow us to read what's on the World Wide Web. So, for instance, nobody thought about eBay until a guy wanted to help his girlfriend find Pez dispensers in the San Francisco Bay Area. All of a sudden now we've got a company with a market value that's higher than most major retailers in this country.
A guy who wanted to find a Pez dispenser? That's how we got eBay?
That's how we got eBay. He was looking for others in the community who might have things that his girlfriend needed. Nice story to tell on Valentine's Day.
Indeed.
And he invented a technology that would help people connect and find material and swap things in online. It wasn't even an auction. It was just a swap meet kind of situation. Eventually, it turned into an auction, and now we have eBay.
Well, forgive those of us who will be just giving cards and sending flowers. We can't all create eBay. Here's Jack in Fairfax, Virginia. Jack, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Coach. Thanks. I appreciate the show, especially Tech Tuesdays. Let me preface this briefly. I've been interested in computers since the 80s because I had a former brother-in-law who had an Apple and I had a neighbor who had an Apple. So I was aware of this. I'm kind of technologically inclined anyhow. I worked for a federal agency. I'll leave their name out, not to embarrass them. Always looking forward to somebody coming in, a new administration that was attuned to this. And nobody really was. By the early 90s, I asked permission, begged permission actually, to go to a government information conference being held in D.C. It must have been about 1990, maybe 1991. And they had something, the U.S. Geological Survey had something they were using that they called the World Wide Web, and they were developing their maps and sharing their maps in this graphical interface, and I was absolutely blown away by this. I mean, the whole concept of it, I had been using bulletin boards before that, kind of like a swap meet. I wish I had thought of eBay, too. The idea of this was so enormous, particularly to federal agencies. I was in the information office of one. I came back the next day with printouts from USGS. There was a company in Maryland offering this Internet service. And I took it to our staff meeting, and I had made copies to send around and showed it to them, told them about it, and everybody else yawned.
I bet they're not yawning anymore, Jack.
Well, they tried to catch up, I think, about 2 or 3 years later. But, you know, there are a lot of missed opportunities there.
Well,
only to laugh about today, unfortunately.
Well, at least we can laugh about it today. But I wonder how many Jacks there were around the world in the late 1980s and early 1990s, Lee.
In many respects, it's the Jacks of the world who have made the Internet environment what it is today. It's the story about individuals who have an interest or a motivation doing stuff. If you talk to people who work for government agencies, for churches, for businesses, a common story that you hear is that some motivated person, usually down the line in the company, not an official, was the first one to twig to the exciting new possibilities that this environment created for us and have convinced some of his colleagues to go along for the ride. In many cases, they built a website, they built an online presence that was not sanctioned by or even noticed by their bosses at first, but eventually it became so important to the company or the church or the nonprofit or the government agency that their bosses finally stood up and took notice. But the story of the internet is the story of empowered individuals who have carried forward a revolution in the way they've created content and the way they've interacted with other individuals.
Jack, thank you very much for calling.
Can I add one thing, Coach Joe?
Please do.
The internet has enabled me to give up my downtown job, and I am a writer. And today, a writer cannot do without the internet. So I work at home thanks to the internet and the World Wide Web.
And you're no longer able to bother those people in those government offices downtown.
No longer have to surprise them with the new technology and have them go, huh?
Hey, Jack, thank you very
much
for your call.
Okay.
Good luck to you. So many people now work in different environments because of the internet, something we don't often think about. But as you know, Lee, the internet started out mainly as a research tool. Has it fulfilled its promise as an educational resource?
I think it has in an informal sense. If you look at formal education, there's a different story from what happens when people are informally looking for information. But if you talk to Tim Berners-Lee, who invented the World Wide Web concept, if you talk to the people who created the internet and its architecture, they were just hoping they could help people communicate with each other. And the fact that there's been such an explosion of information available online has given people new tools, new ways to learn things. It hasn't dramatically affected what happens in classrooms for most of our kids and even at colleges yet. But if you talk to people about how they use the internet, one of the most exciting things is that they can learn new things or they can find out information very quickly and increasingly on the devices and in the places where they want rather than under the circumstances that are dictated by others.
Well, there are people who, I guess, have concern about the internet's growth. If you are one such person, you can call us to join the conversation. What concerns you most about the internet's growth? 800-433-8850 is the number to call. On the other hand, what do you think are the most exciting aspects of the internet's future? You can also send us email to kojo@wamu.org. We're talking with Lee Rainey, director of the Pew Internet and American Life Project. We're going to take a short break as we get your telephone calls and emails. And when we come back, we will continue our conversation on the future of the internet. I'm Kojo Namdi.
Casanova was a world-famous lover, but what if he had just one true love and it ended in tragedy?
Through the book, she comes to a realization about love, and actually she understands that she, with this tough life of hers, has learned much more about love than he with all his wonderful adventures.
A new novel imagines Lucia, the one love who got away from Casanova, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered, beginning this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on WAMU 88.5 FM, your NPR News station. The New Music Center at Strathmore is hosting a free mountain music festival Monday, February 20th from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., featuring the White Top Mountain String Band, Bob Perilla, and Big Hillbilly Bluegrass. For more information, visit strathmore.org.
Support for WAMU comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, the Fannie Mae Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
And from National Geographic Live, presenting Chasing the Tornado with severe storm researcher Tim Samaras, Wednesday, February 15th at 7:30 p.m. at the Grosvenor Auditorium. Information at 202-857-7700. It's currently 43 degrees in northwest Washington. Our forecast for this afternoon, clearing to mostly sunny conditions by later in the afternoon. High temperatures in the lower to mid-40s. Tonight, mostly clear. Lows between 25 and 30 degrees overnight. And now at 12:20, we return to the Kojo Namdi Show here on WAMU 88.5 FM.
It's a Tech Tuesday conversation on the future of the Internet with Lee Rainey, director of the Pew Internet and American Life Project. And now joining us from the studios of CBS News in New York is Esther Dyson, who is editor of Release 1.0 for CNET Networks and organizer of the PC Forum Executive Conference. Esther Dyson, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, I'm glad to be here. And it just shows if the Internet really had all the real-time information, I would have known more about the traffic and arrived earlier.
Well, it's New York. The Internet or nobody else can ever know anything about everything about the traffic in New York. But allow me to start by raising with you a question I raised earlier with Lee, and that is, a lot of people predict that by 2016, computers will be writing most of their own software. How fast do you think technology will progress over the next decade or so?
Well, That's an interesting statement. I think you could make it be true depending on how you define it. But I want to get back to how I started. I really do think that by 2016, you will be able to find out on the Internet the location of every bus in New York. You'll be able to have a good assessment of the traffic. You'll be able to predict your travel times. It's the Internet used to be kind of separate. It was you went to the computer and the computer knew what was on the computer. In the future, the computers are going to know what's happening in the real world. And that's going to be a fundamental difference. You're going to combine the real and the virtual in a way that hasn't really happened yet.
Will they be able to alert us on the progress of negotiations between the transit unions and the people who run the transit agency?
You'll probably be able to measure the blood pressure remotely of the negotiators, and you'll have a much better sense of who's really annoyed and who's just faking. So, yes. But, of course, the control of that information, it's not going to be available to everybody. In principle, all that information is available. There are going to be lots of restrictions on who gets access to it. And how we design those rules is really important.
How would you compare the progress we've made over the last 10 years with the progress we're likely to make over the next 10?
I think the last 10 years have been more revolutionary, because 10 years ago I was on boards where the members didn't use email, and it just – people weren't part of this world. Technologically, there are going to be equally interesting developments, but the major shift in developed countries of people onto the Internet is probably the biggest change now. If you now go into an underdeveloped country – that may happen in the next 10 years. So it sort of depends where you're located. The next 10 years are definitely going to be hugely important in terms of us in the United States understanding that we're part of a bigger world, which I don't think we understand right now. When the Chinese and the Indians all get online, that's going to make a big difference.
In what ways, you think?
The center of gravity is going to change. It may take us a while to notice it, but the Indians and the Chinese will notice it, and there'll be more of them than there are of us.
Lee Rainey, care to comment on the same thing?
There's a wonderful thought in Tom Friedman's book, The Earth is Flat, in which he says that the power that this new set of technologies gives to people around the world means that in the future, a kid who is born in Calcutta with a high IQ will have a better chance of succeeding in the world than a kid who's born in Columbus, Ohio, who has an average IQ. It's a fundamental shift in the way that people deal with each other, in the way that people can move ahead in the world.
Allow me to go to the telephone and talk with Julia in Arlington, Virginia. Julia, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, yes. It's a really interesting conversation. And I was interested in asking your guest whether or not they felt like over the next 10 years that there would still remain a class of people who don't have access to the Internet. I know that underdeveloped nations, that the UN has developed $100 laptops, and there's a lot of school-based programs, but I'm wondering if we don't hear about it as much, whether or not there's still an inequitability of access to these technologies.
Esther?
Yeah, certainly that inequity is going to continue, and it's not simply lack of access to technology. It's also lack of access to money to buy the technology. It's lack of access to education to get a job to earn the money. We're at my conference coming up, we're actually showing one of those under $100 computers from India. It's not designed by the UN. It's designed by a bunch of entrepreneurs in India. that will make a difference. But I think actually you're going to find a lot more people getting onto the internet through cell phones than through computers. But it's still going to be something that's not evenly distributed. Yet I don't think that's the problem. I think there are broader problems that this is only a symptom of, and those have to do with education and poverty and healthcare in general. Computers can help us solve them, but they're not really, I think, the goal. They're simply a symptom of other issues.
Lee Rainey, on the one hand, you talked about what Tom Friedman's book indicates about what access will be able to do for a kid. How about innovation? Will the U.S. continue to be as crucial to internet innovation as it has been, or will Asia or another region eventually catch up and outpace the U.S.?
The power of the internet comes from the fact that it's distributed. Anyone who has access has the power to be online, to connect with other people, and to innovate. As more people from other parts of the world come online, it is clear that the shift in innovation will take place just because they will have things to contribute. And it's likely to be that Americans will still make major, major contributions, invent new applications, new ways to use the internet, new ways to embed it in the environment, as Esther talks about. But it's also the case that we will learn of new ways to do things, not from Americans, but from people who feel just as empowered as those early internet pioneers felt when they started using this.
Here's Les in Herndon, Virginia. Hi, Les. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Coach Joe. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to actually raise a counterpoint to the comment you made a few minutes ago about the effect of the internet on education.
Sure.
I am the proud father of a fifth grade son who had a report on Idaho that he had to do. And instead of going to the school library to find the books on Idaho that they happened to stock, he went to Wikipedia and said, you know, let me look up Idaho, and found many external links from that site with all the information he needed. So it's not so, I'm seeing education being able to distribute the information to everybody, whereas if he had to share, you know, the library with every other student, then he might not be able to get the information he needed.
Can I?
Please, go ahead, Esther Dyson.
I think it's really important not to confuse education with access to information. Education is about the process of a child learning, and you can learn a lot with not a great deal of information. You can learn how to read and write out of three or four books. What's really exciting is the access for information when you get older and you can start doing amazing things, but simply having access to that information is not education. And our challenge is how we help teachers be better teachers, how we use these tools to give individualized instruction to kids. Those are exciting things, but I think education is not simply internet access.
So, Les, whether he got the information from the library or whether he got it online, the point Esther, I guess, is making is that it's more important how he uses that information and how that information contributes to his own educational development.
Yeah,
precisely.
That makes sense.
Okay, Les, thank you for your call. On to Diane in Baltimore, Maryland. Diane, your turn.
Yes, in the first place, I was lucky enough to meet Esther Dyson in Budapest many years ago when she was on a board of directors of a small company there. And I am still in the architecture and construction industry. And one of the things that we continue to see is that all of this technology is allowing us to communicate, but we have yet to get to a level of collaboration with these tools, and we continue to struggle with transactional information standards. And I was just wondering if she had any kind of update on value chains and information value chains that different industries are putting together so that we can truly collaborate online.
Hi, Diane. I'm just sitting here laughing, thinking about the power of radio to reconnect people. It's amazing. I hope I'm providing a useful answer to the question. I think we're developing better tools for managing conversations, for allowing people to have their say. A lot of it actually is more social rules about how to get people to contribute, how to make sure that when you open up an open environment like Wikipedia, for example, it doesn't get overrun with spammers or with congressional staffers trying to burnish their members' reputations or maybe blacken somebody else's. So it's the technology creates the playing field, but then we as human beings still need to make the rules to make that all work. We need to make something worthwhile for people to come to, and then we need to make sure that other people don't mess it up.
Lee Rainey on the same issue.
This is a great point that elaborates what Esther was saying before. One of the things that will change for the better in the next 10 years is our capacity to collaborate. It will be subtle in ways that were not as dramatic to observe as our for sitting down to write our first email. But 10 years from now, when people can get information on the fly, they might get the heart rate of those transit negotiators and be able to pass it along to every other person who cares about the outcome of a potential transit strike in New York. That's a very different model from having the negotiators in a closed-door room eventually coming out and talking to reporters who eventually disseminate the information through their newspapers or through their broadcasts. We are all much closer to that room now and can act in ways that are much more consistent with our needs without necessarily having to go through those intermediaries.
Lee Rainey is director of the Pew Internet and American Life Project. He joins us in the studio in Washington. Joining us from the studios of CBS in New York is Esther Dyson, editor of Release 1.0 for CNET Networks and organizer of the PC Forum Executive Conference. It's a Tech Tuesday conversation on the future of the Internet, which you can join. Has the Internet changed your life? If so, how? You can call us 800-433-8850. Indeed, how do you expect it to change your life in the next decade? You can also communicate with us by email sent to kojo@wamu.org. Will the Internet of the future be a good learning tool, Esther, or will it make it easier for us to avoid thinking?
It will do both. What the Internet really does is it empowers you to do what you want to do. So if you want to do bad things or be lazy, it lets you do that. If you want to learn more, if you want to reach out to other people, if you want to get a group together to go change a law, it enables you to do that too. So it gives us a lot more power. It also gives us more responsibility.
From a social
point of view, the challenge is to make sure that we give more power to individuals, but we use it to constrain the power of big institutions.
I understand whether
those are governments or giant media complexes or big businesses. I think you'll always find power in the hand of individuals is likely to be better used than power in the hands of large institutions. So I'd like to see the Internet used to make sure that we can monitor what our government does as opposed to vice versa.
I'm hearing a lot of talk these days about new technologies like tagging and social. But go right ahead.
The challenge is to make the Internet useful as a tool rather than let people use it to control other people's lives. Are you still there?
We're still here and still listening to you.
Yeah.
I was hearing a lot
I've never been
of...
able to talk quite so much on radio.
Oh, well, we're enjoying it. Feel free to interrupt at will. There's been a lot of talk about tagging and social bookmarking. What are those and why do people think they're so important, Lee Rainey?
The big new thing that the Internet introduced to people's lives is it allowed them to create their own media material. Sometimes it was writing. Increasingly, it's pictures that they take or videos that they take or other artistic work that they take, and they are allowed to put it online so that others who are online can enjoy the same material. It's a very substantial break with the old media model where companies who own broadcast rights or had printing presses gathered information and shared it with individuals, and there was a producer side and a consumer side. Now the boundary between producers and consumers is broken down. So what is happening now with tagging is that people are also being allowed to categorize the information that they gather in ways that are meaningful to them. Esther was showing us the power of tagging, where people can label information, sometimes pictures, sometimes text, sometimes websites, sometimes video, in the ways that they care about. So if you think about it, it's a new kind of library, where instead of us all living under one system called the Dewey Decimal System, we live under a system where we get to label the information we want in the ways that we want it, and we can share it with others who might have the same interest in us or might have the same categories in their heads that we have. So if your listeners want to see what this is like, they should to go to a site called Flickr, which Esther showed us, but also became incredibly important after the London terror bombings in the summer of last year and after the Hurricane Katrina, where a lot of people were posting important pictures that you would call news pictures on this site that they had taken with their digital cameras. They didn't have press cards. They didn't have press badges, but they were functioning as journalists in every true sense of the term.
Well, the other buzzword I'm hearing these days, Esther Dyson, is convergence. And I'm wondering if there's going to be a threshold where people will say, enough, we don't want to be plugged in everywhere all the time. Where does user choice come into play?
Well, I think I'm actually going to go back to Flickr to answer that.
Okay.
People are so fascinated with all this information, search, isn't it great? The truth is there's way too much, and tagging is a way to filter stuff. I don't want to see everything in the world. I just want to see things that are of interest to the group of people I know best. So show me their tags about such and such a topic. I think you're absolutely right. The challenge now is no longer to find information. It's to filter out the stuff you don't want. And we do need to remember, you can turn the thing off. I talk to people, they say, there's so much television I have to watch. And I, who's forcing you to watch the TV? Who's forcing you to read all your emails? There's a lot of spam. There are lots of arguments about filtering spam. I think in the future, eventually, people are going to have whitelists. And people who send email in any large numbers are going to have to pay for that privilege. Those are controversial notions. People really love the notion of the Internet as free and open. But those are idealists who think everybody on the Internet is good. And unfortunately, it's just like real life. There are bad guys out there, too. So it's not pessimistic, but it's realistic to say people are going to want to control their own communities. I don't want to live in a community controlled by someone else, but I do want to control my environment. I should be friendly to strangers, but I don't necessarily invite them all into my house. And so building tools and systems that are based on the Internet to help us control the communities we deal with, the vendors we let know about what we want, the friends whose email we receive, the photos we see, all that are the kinds of things we're going to have to learn, because when the Internet began, it was open and easy. Now we need to have it have that same feeling, but still make it a little safer.
It is my understanding that one of the broad topics of your upcoming conference is called Erosion of Power, Users in Charge, which is, I guess, the issue you have been addressing.
Precisely. How do you make that in a way that's intelligible to people? You can give people all these tools, but they need to figure out how to use them.
On to Stephen in Washington, D.C. Stephen, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thanks very much for taking the call, Kojo. I'd be interested to hear your panelists' views on the tension that continues to exist between, and I suppose it's related in some ways to the conversation we were just having, but the tension that continues to exist between protecting kids from the worst on the Internet, forget the educational side of it for the moment, while at the same time protecting the free speech rights of content providers wherever they come from. And I'd just be interested to see or to hear their views on where they think that's going to go in the next 5 to 10 years, and for that matter, their view on the current proposal for something called a .xxx domain.
Lee Rainey?
The issue is actually going to intensify in coming years as more and more people create their own content and post it online in any of the number of services that allow that to happen, and where they can apply to it any labels that they care about. So the issue of children and inappropriate content has dominated Internet policy discussions since the dawn of the World Wide Web. The attempts to set some sort of legal standards above and beyond the ones that already apply in law have not fared very well. Courts have turned them down, in part because of free speech concerns, in part because they weren't sure that they would be effective. And what you hear from most technologists as they talk about this is some regime of three with several dimensions to it will have to be in place. First of all, parents have to deal with their kids in a responsible way. They have to make sure that their kids are in safe environments. They need to teach their kids about what's right and wrong and where to go and stuff like that. Obviously, technologists will continue to create tools that will allow parents to do some level of that. There's a tremendous market for that. Parents are interested in it, so that the business community will respond to that. And at some point, the policy concerns will kick in, and there will be more attempts to legislate how to get to this. I'm not sure about the XXX domain, since Esther was probably in on some of the deliberations on that, and ICANN. Maybe I'll throw it to her there.
Esther?
Okay, I totally agree with Lee. I think the first thing to talk about is the parents. The challenge right now is often the kids know more than the parents, and the parents don't know what to do about this. They don't understand what the dangers are. They're both paranoid and underinformed. That will change over time, because people having kids will have been using the internet themselves, so they'll know what's involved and they'll know what to do about it, and with luck there'll be more responsible parents. Beyond that, I think you will see, just as anyone gets better at filtering the world around them, I think it'll get easier and simpler for parents to filter their kids' worlds and decide for themselves, is Johnny ready for this or is he not? Just as parents used to decide 50 years ago about magazines or which movies you took your kids to see. On the legislative side, I don't think .xx would work, and I think it's a really, really bad idea, because it will create this presumption that it will work. So I'm hoping that the government doesn't try to get involved with this. I think it should be up to parents, and parents, if they want, can delegate it to a commercial service. My kid can visit these five sites and nothing else, and if he wants to explore elsewhere, we'll go do it together and we'll turn off the filters. That, to me, is the model of the world, rather than a government trying to figure out what's appropriate for everybody, because it can't.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation on the future of the Internet. With a number of emails we've gotten from listeners who offer predictions of their own, I'd be interested in hearing Lee Rainey and Esther Dyson respond to some of those predictions. So we'll do that after we take this short break. Stephen, thank you very much for your call. I'm Kojo Namdi. Coming up at 1, U.S. officials worry about democracy in Russia as the nation's anti-Western rhetoric hardens. Plus, D.C. students share their award-winning love poems today at 1 on the Kojo Namdi Show on WAMU 88.5 FM.
And then at 2 o'clock on Talk of the Nation, efforts to extend the Patriot Act have been stalled in the Senate. Critics say parts of the law unnecessarily erode civil liberties. But last week, key Senate Republicans reached a compromise with the White House, the new Patriot Act, and civil liberties in the age of terrorism. That's Talk of the Nation at 2 o'clock here on WAMU 88.5 FM. Support for WAMU is provided by the German Embassy and the German Information Center, presenting Germany.info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe on the web at Germany.info. And by the Folger Shakespeare Library, valuing learning through the arts, presenting Shakespeare's satire on legislating morality, Measure for Measure, extended through March 2nd. Tickets at folger.edu or 202-544-7077. It's currently 42 degrees in northwest Washington. Our forecast for the afternoon, clearing skies, mostly sunny by later. Highs in the lower to mid-40s. Tonight, mostly clear. Lows overnight, 25 to 30 degrees. And tomorrow, mostly sunny, warmer, highs in the mid-50s. And now at 12:45, we return to the Kojo Namdi Show here on WAMU 88.5 FM.
Using our knowledge of recent history, we're trying to peer into the future of the Internet with Esther Dyson, editor of Release 1.0 for CNET Networks and organizer of the PC Forum Executive Conference, and Lee Rainey, director of the Pew Internet and American Life Project. You can still call us, 800-433-8850, if you'd like to join the conversation, or send email to kojo@wamu.org. Here are three pieces of email that we got, all predictions from listeners. The first from David, who writes, us. I see every computer shrunken down to the size of cell phones and iPods with a boundless number of peripherals that may be attached to your tiny computer wirelessly. Every computer will also take advantage of the internet and distributed computer to form networks of supercomputers around the world. I see computer interfaces going way beyond your standard keyboard and mouse. The computer will integrate itself with our clothes, appliances, desks, equipment, pens, your mind, etc. This one from Phil in Rockville. I think that in 20 years they will be working on ways to directly connect the brain to the internet. It will work easiest for children, like learning a new language. And this from this anonymously. I believe the most exciting thing in the future of the internet will be the development of worldwide consciousness. Starting with you, Esther Dyson, any thoughts on any of those?
The first one is completely true. The second one, the trick isn't connecting your mind to the internet. It's what is at the other end that you connect it to. There are already people working on using electrical impulses of the brain to move muscles around. You'll probably see some of that, but I don't think we're quite going to have telepathy over the internet for a while. The third one is the most interesting. You know, is Google going to turn into some kind of consciousness? If you look at an ant, it doesn't understand us. Is there something out there that we don't understand? I don't know. But it's for practical purposes, I don't think it's going to affect us for quite some time. What is more interesting is the continuous interaction among individuals that's going to create changes in how society is structured. As I mentioned earlier, this erosion of power, because nothing can stay in place very long. The world becomes much more fluid and dynamic as information comes out and sort of erodes all these static positions.
Lee Rainey, I'd like to follow that with this email we got from Danan, because it addresses the point that Esther was just making. Danan says, what will the sense of space be in 2016? I would argue that space has historically been geographical, with the local community or village perhaps being the standard unit and expanding outwardly to larger nations and cultures. It formed the identity and allowed for forums of discussion, education, as well as commerce. With the world increasingly becoming globally connected, will our sense of community and political and social space become increasingly cyber-based and less geographical?
It'll probably head in both directions. The way we use our cell phones now is an early indicator that space will mean less in a pure geographic sense in the future than it now means. When I'm calling one of my children's cell phones, I don't necessarily know exactly where they are, but that doesn't matter to me. It matters to me that I'm talking to my child, and she could be in downtown Tokyo or downtown Tyson's Corner, and it's just good to be able to talk to her. The other direction that this will go is in artificial intelligence and virtual environments themselves. As computing power and communications power gets better, those worlds that we now have on our video screens in front of us will become much more alluring and immersive and realistic. And so our sense of space will be radically changed because of that. There's the debate to be had about whether that's going to be a high-quality experience or a socially distancing experience, but it definitely will change. And I think the nature of community, as the writer was suggesting, is going to adjust to that. I don't think the kinds of communities we have now are going to vanish. We still will care about a relatively small number of important people in our lives. We will be connected to a lot more people in our lives, and we'll use them in different ways. But the sort of standard networks that we now use and communities we're now part of are not going to vanish.
Esther Dyson, this email from Kenneth, I guess, brings us back down to virtual Earth again. Kenneth asks, will viruses, worms, spyware, etc. be eliminated someday?
Okay, let me just say one more thing about what Lee was talking about.
Sure.
Which is, it's so true, and I think we're also going to have a premium on real reality. Everything's going to be automated and all this, and so I can imagine a very upscale hotel in the future saying, we have human room service, and that's considered a real benefit. Back to the more troubling question, no, we're never going to have an end to worms and viruses and spyware, just as, unfortunately, we began with sticks and stones, and we developed bows and arrows, and then we had guns and bombs. we're probably going to get worse rather than better, even as it's going to be a continuing arms race. We're going to have better anti-spyware tools. We're going to have better protective devices. But the only way to stop all this is to kill everybody, because it's bad people who create these things. It's not the technology.
Well, let me go on with the bad stuff for a second, because many people believe that the online world will face some major security threats over the next decade. What kinds of threats, Lee, and what can be done to prevent them?
The threats will take a variety of forms, the most catastrophic of which will be attacks on the networks that would take down the essential services that now increasingly depend on the network. Our utilities run on networked applications. Our banks run on them. People live their daily lives increasingly dependent on the things that they do on the internet. So attacks that cut to the core of those things will have devastating effects. There are, as Esther says, there's a real arms race mentality now, both on the technology side and on the bad guys side, and it's hard to see how it ends, particularly because the internet is becoming ever more important, ever more indispensable to people.
What about online surveillance, Esther Dyson? You mentioned not wanting the government to get involved in certain aspects of this having to do with parents and their children. But how about online surveillance? Will that continue to grow over the next decade, or will we find better ways of keeping our private information secure?
Unfortunately, there's going to be more and more surveillance. And as I said, I just hope that there's enough consumer-citizen surveillance of government to counterbalance government surveillance of citizens. There's also, we need a more transparent world. We're not going to a world where things are more private. If you really want to keep stuff private, don't talk to anybody about it. I mean, that's the best way to do it. So I think people will take it more for granted. They will be more careful about keeping stuff they really want private, and they'll just get used to the fact that they don't really control the other stuff. They can, with luck, control the use of it with laws. But there's always going to be a balance. We never had privacy. People lived with one another in the past. What's different is now the stuff spreads all over the world. On the other hand, most people don't care about it. So it's partly a social adjustment. It's partly having good rules concerning confidentiality. And it's partly having people technically clueful enough to know how to keep the stuff they really want secret.
Here is Philip in Olney, Maryland. Philip, your turn.
I'm 19 years old. I've grown up with the internet. Like, it's becoming and has been a very integral part of my life. And I've dabbled in the computer science world a little bit, so I've been keeping up with the changes and everything that's been happening. And I recently found out that ISPs and telecom, and the telecom industry wants to institute what they're calling a two-tiered internet, which would basically restrict what individuals can do on it, like peer-to-peer content, things like voice over IP, like Skype, and just stuff like that, and then putting their own like preferences on top of that, so that it would basically be limiting what individuals can do at the benefit of themselves and other large corporations. And I wonder what your guests would comment on that. I'll take it off the air.
Philip, thank you for your call. We also got an email from Jessica, George Washington University, who said, "I'm really interested in the future of Internet 2 and when it will become more mainstream. What do you think of Internet 2 and its significance?" Is that the same thing that Philip was asking?
Internet 2 is another internet that now exists mostly among colleges and major research facilities. It's spreading to some school systems now, but it's a system off the main internet because it's much faster and much more oriented towards educational applications and communication among scholars and teachers. I think in the next 10 years, one of the things that's likely to happen is pressures to to set the internet in tiers will grow at a variety of levels. There's now talk, as members of Congress are thinking about rewriting the 1996 Telecommunications Act, about what privileges will be extended to those in the telephone industry and in the cable industry who build out the internet. Will they be allowed to dedicate some portion of the faster pipes that they are building into people's homes or into the airwaves? Will they be able to control what happens on at least a portion of those pipes and privilege the content that they would like to get into people's homes or the content that people have paid to get into their homes at the expense of other internet content? I think that's a major debate we're going to have in the next year or two about how prevalent that might be. But there's also sort of stuff happening on the internet right now that is pushing the internet into a variety of tiers. At one level, for instance, we have the sort of Wild West internet, where people can file the content they want and go on anonymously and check sites and don't have to register for anything. And at a different layer, there are new applications coming on where people do pay for content, and it's more heavily edited, it's more likely to be fact-checked, it's got a brand behind it. The people who get it have to tell who they are and identify themselves. So one of the things that we will see in the next 10 years is this tiering of the internet that will have some pretty interesting policy implications.
Can't go without talking about blogs for a second, Esther Dyson, because there's been a lot of talk about their importance. I know you think that they might be overhyped, but is it possible that blogs might be the first step on a path to some media product that we haven't yet fully imagined?
I think blogs, if you define them as users publishing their own content, are tremendously important. The specific notion of a blog as specifically defined is way overhyped. But yes, you're going to see more and more user-generated content, and the content's going to be not just what you think of as content. It's going to be what Lee was talking about earlier, tagging. It's going to be my classification of the content. It's going to be maybe me saying this channel belongs on that tier or something like that. So the notion of distributed control and distributed content generation is tremendously important, and that's why people are upset about this notion of destroying net neutrality and giving special access to companies who pay for it. I must say, I'd rather have...
Afraid we only have about 30 seconds left.
Okay. Companies only want your money. Governments want your soul. So I'm still... I think the market will work things out. The thing I'm really concerned about is government control of any of this.
Esther Dyson is editor of Release 1.0 for CNET Networks and organizer of the PC Forum Executive Conference. Lee Rainey is director of the Pew Internet and American Life Project. Thank you both for joining us. I'm Kojo Nandi.